eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease and a whole lot of love, you transform 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. LED headlights, spoilers, whatever you need. eBay Motors has it at affordable prices. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride every time. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
I first started running about 15 years ago as a way to quit smoking. Back then, my running clothes were very Rocky Balboa. So sweatpants, sweatshirt. Anyone who goes hiking or trail running knows that it's a lot easier and a lot more fun when you're wearing the right gear. Jonji makes performance apparel that'll take you farther on your runs and hikes. They have this merino wool hoodie that I wore on multiple trail runs this weekend. It's soft, it's warm, and most importantly, it does not get stinky when you get stinky. Another reason to love Jonji is that they donate 2% of all sales towards clean water projects, raising nearly $1 million so far. Head to jonji.com to find your new favorite trail wear, outdoors accessories, and essentials. And use the code OUTSIDE for 10% off at jonji.com. That's JANJI.com with the code OUTSIDE for 10% off. When I was a little kid, my whole family, grandparents included, packed into a Dodge Caravan and went on a two-week road trip to Wyoming. We saw the rodeo in Cody, a grizzly bear in Yellowstone National Park, and an epic thunderstorm near Devil's Tower. On that trip, I fell in love with the West and the natural world. This might sound cheesy, but it kind of made me who I am today. Wyoming has it all. Breathtaking hikes, kid-friendly museums, two of the coolest national parks in the country. The truth lies west. Discover yours at travelwyoming.com.
This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. I'm here with producer Hannah McCarthy. Hi, Hannah.
Hi, Sam Evans Brown.
And senior producer Taylor Quimby. Hi, Taylor.
Hello, Sam Evans Brown.
Now that we all know each other's last names, let's all proceed.
Why do geese make bees?
Does a bumblebee sneeze?
Can a person eat trees?
Can a polar bear freeze?
Is a kidney stone kind of like a pearl in a clam?
Well, I don't know. Ask Sam.
Never gets old.
Now I'm in the mood for it.
Hi, I'm Aaron from San Diego, California. And I'm glad you guys said no question is too silly because I've been wondering this for a while, but everybody laughs at me when I ask it. When a caterpillar becomes a butterfly. All right, so caterpillars have a bunch of little legs, but butterflies only have six legs. I'm like, where do all the legs go? Anyway, so hope you guys can answer that for me. Thanks. Bye.
Oh, God. Where do they all go?
Where do they go?
Yeah, but this was the subject of a wonderful radio lab.
But caterpillar / butterfly legs was the subject of a... were the subject?
Not legs specifically, but caterpillar / butterfly metamorphosis.
Okay, all right.
And how crazy it is.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's what happens. They go into the chrysalis, and they turn into a pupa. And they liquefy, like,
yeah.
All these enzymes get released that sort of digest their body and turn it into, like, the building blocks of a butterfly. And apparently that Radiolab episode is kind of oversimplifying. It's not like the entire caterpillar liquefies and then a butterfly is formed whole cloth. I mean, parts of it turn into goo, and there are some structures that are still there. There are some body parts that are kind of getting moved around, but when it's all done, there is a butterfly.
Does it have the same brain? Is it the same entity?
This is the Radiolab story
that, oh, okay.
That we are never
going to
do as well as they did.
Maybe we could just play it four times fast.
And cue Radiolab.
Hey, I'm Chad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab. And today
we are doing our black box.
Yeah, the black box is it's a thing. With a...
I think the question that we maybe should answer is, are the legs that the butterfly has from the caterpillar? Are those the same legs? Or do all the legs liquefy and do they grow brand new
legs? That's a good one. I called up Gwen Pearson, who we have talked to in the past. She is my favorite Twitter insect person. and runs the sort of like bug zoo at Purdue University.
Hello, Gwen Pearson.
So what Gwen said is we've got the basic picture right. Parts of the caterpillar get digested, but other structures remain. Their circulatory system's still there. Their respiratory system's still there. And the legs are also still there as well.
So the legs don't go anywhere.
The legs don't go anywhere. In fact, we are confused about what a leg is.
You're blowing my mind.
Ready? Here's Gwen.
Have you really looked at a caterpillar, man? So a caterpillar has two different kinds of legs. And the legs that are just behind their head are sort of their proper insect legs. And those are jointed legs, and they're hard. And those are the same legs that will later become their moth or butterfly legs. But
okay.
Behind that, they have all of these little blurpy, blobby legs. and so because they're such fat little pudge babies, they have all these rolls. And so those feet that they have, the extra feet, are actually just blobby extensions of their body. And so it's like if I could use my extra donut handles as an appendage.
So that is the answer. The legs don't go away. They sort of like reform as slightly different legs, but the back legs, which are called prolegs, those get reabsorbed and turned into butterfly tissues.
But they're not legs at all. They're actually not extensions of fatty tissue. Like when a baby is still super chubby, if they could like crawl using their fat or something.
Yeah, if they could like manipulate their fat roll so that it could move back and forth, that's what caterpillar legs are.
I never thought of a caterpillar as a toddler until this point, or like a baby learning to crawl. But
yeah,
I kind of do.
Hi, Sam and everyone else. I have a question about animals and how gay they are. I've heard about some animals being pretty gay, and sometimes they only mate to make baby animals. Otherwise, they hang out with other genders just for fun. I don't know. So basically, how queer are animals? Which ones are the gayest? I'd love to know. All right. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
That's a great question.
Yeah.
And I'm sure someone will have more insights as to the answer than us. Because my insight is basically the same as hers, which is like, I've heard that some are pretty gay.
Yeah.
Can I just add that I know that the segment is called Ask Sam, but everybody else, come on.
Come on.
Hey, Sam.
I'm hurt.
And chopped liver. Sorry, guys.
I'm just kidding.
Hi, I'm Karen Bondar. I am a biologist, author, and TV host.
Okay, so for this one, we talked to Karen Bondar, who looks at this specifically, animal sexuality. And the basic consensus is that, I'll just let her say it.
In the animal kingdom, I frankly have yet to find an animal who isn't at least a little bit gay. They are all queer. Absolutely. And I would say that with a good deal of certainty and authority.
So the takeaway, I think, here is basically there's a huge amount of just sort of like indiscriminate sexuality in the animal kingdom. And the gender animals are fooling around with doesn't seem to really cross their mind all that much. And it's basically like they don't have hang-ups.
For the rest of the animal kingdom, sex is as normal as eating breakfast or, you know, doing any number of relevant normal living activities. And so it's just no biggie.
And the last thing that I thought was kind of funny is that it's actually less useful to think of, what is the gayest species and think more of, just as we do with people, that there are individual animals that might be more prone to be homosexual versus like, are bonobos the gayest?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me bonobos are the gayest.
We tend to think that all animals act kind of similar. You know, there's a donkey over there. What are donkeys like, you know? Well, guess what? All the donkeys have personalities too.
Well, I really like that.
Yeah, me
That's
too.
A really nice takeaway. You know, I watch a lot of nature shows with my son, and there's very much this sort of like, how does the snake behave? You know, and I don't know. You don't think of animals as individuals unless they're pets.
Well, yeah. And so this was one of the really interesting things, is that there's a huge amount of bisexual behavior in mm-hmm. animals who are willing to hook up with whatever. There's very little exclusive homosexuality where there are animals that say, I will only hook up with animals of my same gender. And in fact, the only animal that we know that is exclusively homosexual are sheep. 10% of male rams will reject females.
Wow.
Male rams. 10% of rams will reject females. And that's like one of the only other species that...
Like the only one. That's so interesting. Yeah,
that we know of.
That we know of, exactly.
What? So what about... Did she have anything to say, or are we going to get into which is the gayest animal? Or are we deciding that as a question maybe just doesn't quite make sense?
Well, the one that's often cited and that she did touch on slightly are bonobos, mm-hmm. who are... The monkey that we are most similar to genetically, but the reason that they're often cited as the gayest is because they are so sexual generally mm-hmm. that a lot of their interactions are homosexual.
We get to see a lot of it,
right?
Yeah.
Well, and they're just like constantly having sex,
right?
And so like when you're constantly having sex and you're sort of indiscriminate, a lot of that is going to be homosexual.
Well, and to be, you know, like gay is a sort of an identifier. It's something that you would describe yourself as based off of, you know, how you feel and who you're attracted to. But even as like humans are sort of starting to say, like, we need more ways of describing how we feel and what we're attracted to. We understand now, like, I might be pansexual or demisexual or all these, you know, or bisexual. And when it comes to animals, we're still like, is it gay or not gay?
And animals are like,
that's an interesting
point. Put your labels on me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this next one, I should say that we have been getting so many questions that we can't answer them all. So I'm sorry to those of you out there who don't have your question answered. We've got one gentleman who has called so many times. I feel like we really need to answer one of these questions.
Hey, Sam, this is Jerem from Dallas, Texas.
Hey, Sam, this is Jerem from Dallas, Texas.
Hey, Sam, this is Jerem.
Hey, Sam, this is Jerem from Dallas, Texas again.
So he's asked many good questions.
Where's he from?
From Dallas, Texas.
Oh.
he's asked a bunch of questions. This is the one we're going to answer today, I think.
So just kind of the basis of a living fossil means that the genetic makeup hasn't really changed a whole lot over a couple thousand years, kind of like alligators and the such. Forgive me if I'm wrong, but humans haven't really changed a whole lot over a couple thousand years. So would we be considered living fossils, or what are we? So, yeah, thank you, and bye.
Is that the definition of living fossil? I mean, certainly not thousand. Like, he's off by a couple orders of magnitude, I think. But isn't the definition of living fossil something that exists in the fossil record but is also still alive today?
Oh.
Yeah, that's my understanding, although I don't know if there's like a specific time. You know, like when I think about living fossils, I think of millions of years.
Yeah, thousands was not. That's definitely not the definition.
So that leads me to think, no, that we're not living fossils.
Is there an exact definition of living fossil?
This sounds like someone we should call and get answers to both of those questions.
So we called Brian Switek, who is a writer with Scientific American, who has thought about this specific question.
And just so you know, in terms of name pronunciation, if that comes up, my last name is pronounced Switek, and I'm the author of a book called My Beloved Brontosaurus.
And one of the first things he said is, of course, there isn't a real definition for living fossil, which is part of why this is a problem. So defining something that has no definition is like, you know. Mm. So one of the things that Jerem said was he thought the definition was something that hadn't changed genetically in a really long time, which if you get genes into it, immediately gets you into trouble.
From a genetic standpoint, there can't be anything as a living fossil because there's a change every time there's a new generation. Yeah, even though anatomically, there might not be a lot of change genetically, there's just this riot of evolutionary change that's constantly going on.
So if we are talking about genes, living fossils don't exist ever at all.
Mm-hmm.
Even like the coelacanth and all these things that are like the classic living fossil are genetically different from the ones that existed millions of years ago.
Yeah.
But does that also mean that the things that we think of as living fossils, like sharks and alligators, it's not like they stopped evolving. they are evolving. It's just they look the same.
Right. And since the problem is that we don't have a very good definition of what a living fossil is, I'd like to propose an alternate definition that comes from a story that Brian told about a tree called the Metasequoia.
So this is a tree that's known from the fossil record as a fossil record that goes back, if I remember correctly, about 50 million years or so. And that's how it was first identified. That's how it was first named. It turned out to still be alive in forests in China. So that is like literally a living fossil, something that we thought was long gone, that we named from the fossil record. There it is, still growing in the modern world.
So that's my proposal for a new definition of living fossil, something we thought was extinct, and then we found it actually still alive.
But isn't that
Metasequoia.
Metasequoia, hasn't it changed genetically?
Oh, for sure.
Since, okay.
Yeah.
So it's
we're
still...
Let's get rid of this whole...
Just that we thought that it was gone,
yeah,
but it isn't.
And it's, I feel like that's a more functional definition with like bright, hard lines of what is and is not a living fossil.
So if, for example, a crack opened up in the earth and like a Tyrannosaurus Rex came out, we'd be like, oh,
there's a living fossil.
We thought that was extinct, but I guess not. And then we'd run away.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Next one.
Focus.
Hi, it's Sherry calling from Dr. Metcalf's office. Just calling to remind you of your appointment with us on Monday at 2 o'clock. We'll see you then. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Oh, burn. That person did not go to their doctor's appointment.
Slash, that person who left that message was not paying attention to the answer machine message. That
they left that after the outside in theme and me going, you've called the Ask Sam hotline. Man, autopilot.
Okay, let's take a breather. Let's come back to this after a second.
Take a knee.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease and a whole lot of love, you transform 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. LED headlights, spoilers, whatever you need. eBay Motors has it at affordable prices. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride every time. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Welcome back to Outside In. Today we are asking listener questions from the Ask Sam hotline mailbox where they accumulate forever.
Not to correct you, but we're not asking the questions. We're answering the questions.
Yeah. Proceed.
My name is Catherine, and I was wondering the other day how much it costs on average to ride in the elevator instead of taking the stairs. I was in a building in Austin, Texas. It was just a two-story building with a very, very slow, big elevator. And it struck me as kind of silly to take the elevator. And then I thought, you know, I wonder what it costs in terms of, like, installing the elevator, maintenance and upkeep on the elevator, and then just the energy to make it go up and down. Thanks. Bye.
Before you guys get going on this, this is actually a perfect opportunity for a segment that we've been thinking about. This is an idea from Cordelia Zars, Outside In contributor. It's a little something that we're going to call Sam Ruined It.
When you like to do a thing because you think that it's a good thing, then you tell Sam and he says,
That's a bad thing.
People everywhere are going to do their thing, but Sam ruined it.
Oh, jeez. Well, I like that we're fully, you know, turning me into a cartoon character. I'm ready for it. Do you guys take the elevator every day?
I tend to take it up, mm-hmm, and then take the stairs down.
I do a little bit of both. If I'm in a rush, I'll take the elevator, and I don't know if that actually makes sense.
It's actually, I'm not sure that this is the perfect thing for the Sam Ruined It segment.
I thought for sure you were going to tell us that elevators are like costly and put out tons of carbon and...
Well, okay, so what I know about elevators is that they're actually a very efficient way to move people through space, because they're like, it's basically like a train, right? They're like a train car on some rails that goes up and down instead of side to side. And not only that, they have this thing called a counterweight, which is as the elevator goes up, there's a weight that's going down, right? And the counterweight is depending on the elevator, weighs about as much as the thing when it's loaded to like 40% capacity. Mm-hmm. So you can think of it almost like a seesaw, yeah. right?
Or a grandfather clock.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
And so like if you're thinking about a seesaw, like it doesn't take a ton of effort to push. Like even if you're with a pretty big person on the other side, it doesn't take a ton of effort to push them up into the air. And then when you're lowering them back down, when you're coming back down, that's no work because the weight is sort of like doing the work for you.
Yeah. Well, also it's an accessibility question, right? So it's like you want to have the elevator there for people who can't take the stairs. The question ends up being a sort of a judgment one, not unlike the small you made when I said,
yeah.
when I said that I take them up, which is that people who could walk tend to take the elevator. I will say that I've gotten on the elevator with, you know, going up to the sixth floor, and when I see people getting off at the second floor, I tend to cock my head a little bit, like, really?
One flight of stairs, guys?
I judge heavily when people do that. Or when they just take it one flight down to the basement. That's even worse. You could roll down the stairs.
You trip and fall. And you'd be fine. I did Google this at one point, and like the energy used by elevators in large office buildings is actually less than the energy saved when they went from like regular to CFL light bulbs.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's a very small amount of energy
wow.
in the grand scheme of things.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Well, you officially haven't ruined elevators then.
Yeah.
Got to ruin something else.
Yeah, we need, okay. For the purpose of this segment, you still need to ruin something. So, Sam, what do you got?
What, just on the spot? Just
yeah.
like that?
Yeah.
How about artisanal light bulbs?
What? That's a thing?
Have you ever like gone to a restaurant and seen like the old-timey looking long...
Oh, I love those.
Yeah.
Like the Edison
so
incandescent.
Stupid. So stupid.
Do you mean from an efficiency standpoint?
Yes. They're like 10 times less efficient. And why? And why? Because they look old. And people are like, well, that looks old.
Okay, just one more thing. Ruin one more thing.
Something that people really love.
Hybrid cars.
What? No. That's an episode. You can't just ruin hybrid cars real quick during an Ask Sam.
They're not much better for the environment than regular cars.
No way. What about when I finally get my Tesla? Will I be a champion of...
Electric cars are better than hybrid cars. The problem with a hybrid car is you've got two drivetrains in one, and you've got this giant battery, and you've got this giant gas engine. And so like, you know, first of all, you add layers of cost, but just generally not that much more efficient.
So do you mean like, so a solar panel, for example, it creates carbon in its manufacturing process, but eventually, you know, you can sort of make that back because it's energy. And in the case of a hybrid car, there's just so much stuff in a hybrid car because you have to have the two drivetrains that it takes much longer to recoup that investment.
Yes. And not only that, they're not so much more efficient than a regular car that they're like recouping it really quickly. Hmm. Right. You know, the Prius gets like 50 miles to the gallon if you're lucky. If you drive like many normal people, they get more like 40 miles to the gallon. You can find a small, just a regular car that gets 40 miles to the gallon.
My Honda Civic gets around that. Yeah.
Oh. And so for all that, you know, expense and batteries and having a new drivetrain in there, you get what? A couple miles per gallon.
Dang.
All right.
You did ruin it.
Ruined.
I believe we are now ready to go back into a normal Ask Sam. Okay. Question number, whatever we're on.
Hi, my name is Kenneth from Pennacook, and I've heard tale of some crazy people out there who ride their bikes to work in sub-zero temperatures. And I'd like to ask Sam specifically, what would lead someone to do such a foolish thing? Thanks.
Should I reveal that I knew this question was coming?
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Well, I knew that you were riding your bike in sub-zero temperatures the other week.
Is this a friend of yours criticizing you?
No, it's not. It's someone from Twitter.
Ah, okay.
Legitimately, though, I think he raises an important point that you are crazy.
No, that is wrong.
How cold was it when you were riding the other week during the, you know, bombogenesis?
Negative 18.
Would it have been worth it? If you ended up with a little bit of frostbite on your knuckles or something, if...
This is a loaded question. This is a loaded question. It's like, if you had lost your entire face, wouldn't you have reconsidered? Yes, I would have reconsidered.
Okay, so tell us how you did it then, because you seem to do it without much.
It's fine.
Yeah, yeah.
It's fine.
So what's the strategy? Like, what do you need? What's the
just take all your clothes and put them on, and then you ride to work. No, but actually though, that's like literally all I do.
You don't have.
I have two pieces of specialized gear.
Okay,
I have these things called bar mitts, which are a neoprene cover.
Okay.
So they go over your handlebars and you stick your hands inside them and then grab your brakes and your shifters and stuff inside the bar mitts. Mm-hmm. So I have those. And then when it gets really cold, I'll wear a glove inside those.
And that's a specialized thin glove?
Yeah. Okay. No, just regular gloves.
Oh, regular
gloves. I buy literally the cheapest gloves I can find.
Okay.
Real quick, have you considered that if you know a young Jewish cyclist coming of age that you can get them bar mitts for their bar mitzvah? That's a great pun.
I've never heard that joke before.
Oh, wait, is that a common cyclist joke?
Aww.
Every time someone sees the bar mitts, it's the first thing they say.
I thought that was really good.
Thank you. Hannah and I are clearly not in the cycling forums.
What do you do with your face?
So for the face, have you heard of a buff? Buffs, I mean, you can just wear a scarf. It doesn't have to be anything. A scarf or a balaclava. But I use a buff, and I have a two-buff system. But it's just like, it's like a thin piece of stretchy fabric that you put on. It's like a neck gaiter. And so you've seen people wearing them for sure.
Yeah.
And Buff is the brand name. They're not all actually buffs at this point. It's like Kleenex at this point. They call them buffs even though they're not. So I wear one, and I pull it. So I put it on my chin, and then I pull it up so that it goes over the top of my head so it covers my cheeks. And then I have a second one that I pull up over my like nose and mouth so that it comes at a lower angle. But my whole face is covered except for my eyes. And when you breathe into anything that's covering your face like that, your breath actually warms up your whole head. And there was actually this article that I was reading the other day that was talking about how there was some military experiment where they gave people a balaclava and then they gave people a hat and then they asked them to rate how cold different parts of their body felt. And people with a balaclava actually said their fingers and toes felt warmer than people with a hat.
Interesting. Hmm.
And then the other piece of specialized gear I have is I have shoe covers. So I put on warm socks and then I cover my shoes up. And that keeps my hands warm, my feet warm, my face warm. And I usually get to work kind of sweaty.
Wow. What would be the limit? I mean...
Well, negative 18 is the coldest I've done so far. Doesn't seem to be the limit. I was still sweaty.
Yeah. Wow. So before we end the show, we've actually got a great comment in from a listener as well who listened to the last Ask Sam. And I don't know if you remember. This one was Sam, you, Hannah, you were there, but also producer Jimmy Gutierrez. And at one point you started talking about the dead man's float and
bottling. Bottling and logging.
Yeah, yeah, and whether or not it serves any purpose. So let me just play the clip.
In what situation would that help you?
Well, I mean, scaring small children at the beach.
Yeah.
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 Avoiding laundry.
Just lie face down on the floor and wait till Aubrey says something.
So we actually got a call from a listener about this one.
Hi there, Sam, Hannah, and Jimmy. This is Adrian from Mount Vernon, New Hampshire. I'm actually an officer in the Navy. I'm a surface warfare officer, and we call a dead man's float a prone float, but we actually use it in our second-class swim call, so a required swim call for all Navy personnel, because a dead man's float or prone float is actually the best way to conserve energy. So you are face down, you keep your face in the water, you relax all your body and arch your back. And every couple seconds, 30 seconds or so, you roll over, take a breath, and roll back under. So we do it if we abandon ship. So that's why you use a dead man's float. Thanks. Bye-bye.
That is boggling.
Isn't that cool?
That's wild.
Yeah.
Why is that more energy efficient for the body than lying on your back?
She left a long message, so I clipped out a teeny portion. She actually said that one of the other reasons is that because if you're trying to do it on your back, and you're especially in the ocean, waves have a tendency to really lift you up and slap you in the face and can cause you to panic. And so I think part of it might be even to regulate your breathing a little bit.
And I also assume that for this to work as a way to survive, you have to be pretty well dressed if you're in the ocean. Because,
yeah.
Like, you know, you're going to be freezing and go hypothermic pretty quickly if you're just lying there motionless in the water.
So you don't pull a Leo DiCaprio.
I'll just sink slowly to the bottom. I mean, that's always an option.
I think that would conserve the most energy, actually.
Outside In was produced this week by me, Sam Evans-Brown, Hannah McCarthy, and Taylor Quimby, with help from Ben Henry, Maureen McMurray, and Justine Paradise. If you liked these questions and would like to have even more information about the answers, please head to our website. The address is outsideinradio.org. If you didn't like these questions and think you've got a better one, you should give us a call. The number is 1-844-GO-OTTER. Alternatively, you can just pester us on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook. We're at Outside In Radio on all of those platforms. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. Oh, and special thanks to Nick Capodice for the Sam Ruined It theme song. Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.